In Ukraine, some civilians have managed to flee a besieged steel plant, mainly elderly women, children, and mothers.
Questions remain about what will happen to the men, men who are seen as being of fighting age. Will they be allowed to leave?
Also today, we take stock of where the Russian military is at. Even as they shift strategy, the facts remain.
This was not going to be a fair fight. From the very beginning, I thought Ukraine's will and morale was going to provide a David to the Russian Goliath.
And the connection between high walls along the U.S.-Mexico border and local emergency rooms.
Anything over about 12 feet, we start seeing a great increase in significance of injury and complexity of injury.
And Muslims around the world mark the Feast of Eid. We've got the menu. I'm Marco Werman. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for being with us on this Monday. The evacuation of the Ukrainian city of Mariupol continues today. It's possibly the last chance for hundreds of civilians to escape the city, even as Russian forces shell it. Civilians in Mariupol have been trapped for weeks in bunkers beneath the wreckage of a former steel plant. Meanwhile, Russian troops are also focused on the Donbas region in eastern Ukraine. For an overview of where things stand in this war, I'm joined by retired U.S. Army General Mark Hertling. General Hertling, it's been described as the second phase of this war, with Russia focused on Ukraine's east. How do you see the fighting as different in this phase?
Well, Marco, what I'll suggest is the Russians have massively shifted their objectives from very large objectives on multiple fronts to a more limited approach. They certainly want to keep their objective of controlling the Sea of Azov and the Black Sea and gaining control of the major port cities on both of those coasts. But they've also redirected their major efforts to chopping off a portion of eastern Ukraine. It appears to me, as from a military perspective, that they are failing in reaching any of their strategic or operational objectives over the last several months.
Assess for us Ukraine's ability to push back against Russia in the Donbas and in southern Ukraine.
Yeah, I think it's been very good from the very beginning. And it's certainly even, in my view, better now, primarily because the frontage that the Ukrainian army is facing has been reduced significantly. And the fact that they are getting unbelievable support from not only NATO and the United States, but other allies as well. And I think that we're going to see not only the continued resolve of the Ukrainian people, and in fact, probably more resolves given the fact that they have seen Russia commit multiple atrocities throughout their campaign. But I also think that you're going to see the potential for a rearmed Ukrainian force with modern technology and the capability to counter some of the Russian forces. You add that to the fact that since the very beginning, there are indicators that the Russian soldiers, who were primarily conscript, did not know what the mission was. I know from my time in Europe as the commander of U.S. Army forces in Europe and engagements with Russian troops, how they are trained, how they conduct exercises, and how their leaders establish trust. And, you know, I could tell even going into this campaign that this was not going to be a fair fight. From the very beginning, I thought Ukraine's will and morale was going to provide a David to the Russian Goliath.
Hmm. There have been recent reports that the chief of the general staff of Russia's military, General Valery Gerasimov, was near the front lines in eastern Ukraine. What was someone with such a high rank doing there?
Truthfully, Marco, I was scratching my head on that one too. But the very fact that you have seen Russia appoint a commander, General Dvornikov, to command the Ukrainian operation and allegedly is coordinating the actions of the Army, Navy, and Air Force. And then suddenly you have the equivalent of the U.S. Chief of the Joint Staff in the area of operations at a particular battlefield tells me that there's something desperately wrong with the Russian command and control system. To see a four-star general who has been the counterpart of our U.S. generals Dempsey and Dunford and now General Milley since 2012 suddenly appearing on one battlefield front, it just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me, especially when another general is commanding the entire operation.
So, General, let's talk about how long Ukraine can keep Russia at bay. I mean, the U.S. is providing Ukraine with billions of dollars in military support. Other countries are, too. How significant is this support? Is it enough?
In the first phase of the operation, when the emphasis was on handheld devices, manned portable air defense and Javelin missiles and some of the drone, and while at the same time access to intelligence, it was important to help Ukraine maneuver and conduct a hasty defense in the northern regions. What we're talking about now in the east and the south is true combined arms conventional warfare. So whereas the type of maneuvers have changed, we still see some of the same fallacies within the Russian army, not being able to conduct what are very difficult, by the way, combined arms operation, combining tanks, infantry, artillery, close air support, engineers, followed up by logistics. It's just not happening for the Russian. And that just talks more to their command and control, the way they have trained, and the fallacies they have in terms of attempting to execute attacks along a wide front.
So there is the hardware support. The U.S. and other countries are also training Ukrainian troops outside of Ukraine in countries like Poland and Romania. What does that kind of training look like, and how significant is that?
Many people don't realize this, but the United States and other countries have been training Ukrainian individual soldiers and Ukrainian units up to the battalion level for the last 6 or 7 years. So from a military perspective, Ukraine's army has already begun their transformation to a Western-style force, and that's been taking place over the last almost decade or so. Now, what you ask about, though, was the individual equipment. Whenever you offer new types of equipment, different technologies on the battlefield, what you normally do is pull a certain segment of the army away, hopefully a small segment, and train them on the intricacies of that equipment. So what is occurring now, someplace in Europe, are the training of Ukrainian soldiers, artillerymen, on the use of that kind of equipment. That small group of individuals who are training somewhere in Europe is then taken back to the front line, and those individuals who have been trained become the trainers of other Ukrainian forces.
So, General, U.S. officials are saying that the U.S. will support Ukraine until victory. What does that mean, though, and what does victory look like?
Well, from a military perspective, and I think I'm echoing what President Zelensky has said, victory would mean the reestablishment of Ukraine's sovereignty within their borders. Now, the key question then becomes, does that mean the total elimination of any Russian forces in the Donbas and a retakeover of Crimea? I don't know. That's something that the political masters have to determine. But I think from a standpoint of victory, when you're talking about the sovereignty of a nation in the middle of Europe, it would seem to me that that would be what victory would look like.
I mean, there is a possibility that this war just drags on for a long time. Would the U.S. simply continue the same policy, providing weapons and financial support as Russia bombs Ukraine? Is that sustainable?
I think if this turns into a long war, what you're going to see in the next phase of the operation, as much as we're passing a lot of Western equipment, Western technologies and intelligence to the Ukrainian military and government, I think what you may see if it turns into a long war, that there will be a transformation of the Ukrainian military writ large. They'll be fielding more Western equipment. They will be ensuring training continues to counter any kind of Russian activity. I don't see this turning into the type of frozen conflict we see in Abkhazia or South Ossetia. You know, the Russians have stoked these kind of frozen conflicts throughout different parts of Europe. They will occupy certain parts of landmasses of a sovereign country and then just stay there. I don't think we're going to see the same thing in Ukraine because of the will and the desires of Ukraine's people and their government.
Retired U.S. Army General Mark Hertling speaking with us about the latest in Russia's war against Ukraine. Very good to hear your thoughts, General. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Buses filled with dozens of civilians who've been sheltering in bunkers beneath a steel plant in Mariupol headed out of the city this weekend. They were bound for Zaporizhia, a city more than 100 miles to the northwest. Associated Press reporter Kara Anna is in Zaporizhia. I asked her about the fate of those Ukrainians who remained behind in Mariupol.
Questions remain about what will happen to the fighters, the wounded fighters. And then what will happen with the men? Men who are seen as being of fighting age, will they be allowed to leave? To what point have they been discussed in these negotiations to even make this happen?
You're in Zaporizhia, Kara. What is life like there right now?
I will start by saying it's spring. We've seen that arrive. So it's actually warm. You have this interesting experience of being in a very industrial, you know, you can see touches of the Soviet era city, the smokestacks is still belching smoke. But then you also have spring. You have these cottages with tulips, people carrying daffodils, a lot of flowers on Sunday as people marked the Day of the Dead here, which is the first Sunday after the Orthodox Easter. So amid all this grim news and talk of explosions and further killing and more bodies found in places like Bucha, you have this, at the same time, blue sky, flowers, little kids running around, colorful playgrounds. Life, oddly enough, goes on as usual in certain ways.
Has Zaporizhia been under attack, and are residents worried about the war getting closer to them?
They are worried. It's possible to drive through town and think, well, where is the war? Of course, then you come across checkpoints. But last week, we arrived shortly after a Russian rocket struck a residential neighborhood. And that was the first strike of a residential neighborhood in Zaporizhia since the invasion. Now, an emergency responder told us that their target was not necessarily this neighborhood. It had been hit by anti-aircraft system from the Ukrainians. But still, you had essentially 8 houses destroyed or damaged and at least 3 people wounded.
The people leaving Mariupol, what kind of route are they taking to get to Zaporizhia? And do we know how safe it is?
Yeah, we don't know exactly the route. The UN and the ICRC have been very quiet about the details of this while stressing that the sort of public information coming out, they worried that, you know, too much talk could jeopardize the safety of the people involved. But we have been speaking today with people from Mariupol who took advantage of the ceasefire that occurred when people were being taken out of the plant.
What were they telling you?
Well, of course, a very tense drive, many, many checkpoints, more than 20, at least along the routes that people took. And a lot of nervousness, a lot of relief when they make it here. There's concern at every single checkpoint. That's what people keep saying. You just don't know what you're going to experience at the next one. And that's a long time to be stressful.
Kara, do you have any reason to believe that civilians in the Mariupol steel plant, as of still, are afraid to board buses to leave because they think they'll be taken to Russia or that maybe the evacuation is not sincere?
Well, that's what we're asking as well, in fact. We are asking the UN and the ICRC that same question.
We know this evacuation was a long, grueling process to get there. Do you know how it was even negotiated?
They did tell me that it was, UN teams, the UN, the ICRC, and the 2 governments involved, and then certain agencies in the UN in both countries. But as far as the ins and outs of what deal was struck and by whom, you had the UN Secretary General, of course, visiting both countries in recent days. That must have played a major role.
Well, we have seen ceasefires tried to get established to create humanitarian corridors, but those have often failed. Is this evacuation then kind of a breakthrough?
They certainly are looking at it as such. Yes, and particularly since this involves the people who have been trapped at the steel plant. Mariupol has been seen as hell, as a city, and now the steel plant itself has been another level of it. So getting people out of there safely to here, I think, would be seen as a breakthrough. How long that breakthrough lasts and whether more can come, those are questions we're posing.
Associated Press reporter Kara Anna is in the southern Ukrainian city of Zaporizhia. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
The effort to document war crimes in Ukraine has strong international support. The International Criminal Court is already on the ground collecting evidence. But actually putting a former national leader on trial at The Hague? The World's Chris Harlan Dunaway explores that question in a story about a surprising relationship that formed during the trial of the former president of Serbia, Slobodan Milosevic. That's at theworld.org. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. There has been an alarming rise in injuries and deaths of people trying to scale the walls along the U.S.-Mexico border. The Trump administration, as you will recall, raised the height of barricades to 30 feet in some places. And since then, trauma surgeons in the area say the number of deaths and injuries have increased fivefold. Those findings are in a new study in the journal JAMA Surgery. Dr. Amy Lippert at UC San Diego is lead author of the study. Doctor, first, some numbers. How many deaths were there before the walls were raised, and how many after?
When we look at the 3 years, 2016, 17, and 18, we found no deaths. In the 3 years following that we looked at, 2019, 2020, 2021, we found 16 deaths.
Tell us about some of the injuries you and the other San Diego trauma centers have been seeing at your hospitals.
Well, I think what struck us is that the fractures, particularly that we were seeing of mostly legs, but some arms, were multiple pieces, badly broken, oftentimes open fractures, setting up for infections, needing multiple takebacks to the operating room and advanced surgical procedures by our orthopedic colleagues. We also saw other complex injuries such as traumatic brain injuries, pelvic fractures, and multisystem injury, as well as facial fractures.
Are we talking walls that are so high that inevitably a fall will result in trauma, or is something else going on?
Anything over about 12 feet, we start seeing a great increase in significance of injury and complexity of injury. And so if someone is scaling a 30-foot barrier or on anything of 30 feet of height, the amount of force that's generated from the body falling to the ground is going to create greater injury.
How are those who are injured actually treated? Are they asylum seekers who get proper health care?
Well, one of the things we're afforded in this country is that anyone that comes into my trauma bay, I'm going to treat regardless of their life circumstances, U.S. citizen or not. The patients that I care for are critically ill to a point that we don't look into that information, and we treat everyone equally and provide the medical care.
If the injuries have gone up fivefold since these walls went up, I mean, how has that affected the overall health system along the border?
It's been a big stress to our hospital and the other trauma centers, particularly the other trauma center who sees these patients on a regular basis. UC San Diego Health that I work for covers all of downtown San Diego all the way down to the border. And we also cover any patients that are out in the desert that would be injured would get transferred to us. We actually take what we call border call or anything coming from the border or injuries from the border every other month and trade back and forth with the other trauma center in town. With the exception of those patients coming from the farther distance, we take them all the time.
So, Dr. Lippert, what are you most worried about this current situation? What do you think the public really needs to understand about what's going on?
I think it's really twofold. It's really a humanitarian problem with these immigrants trying to gain access to the United States. But beyond that, locally, the stress to my colleagues and everyone in the hospital I work for, as well as the entire system, is overtaxed and overstressed. And so if we're going to continue with the current barrier, we need to ensure that we have adequate resources, as most of these patients are unfunded, not only to care for them, but just as importantly, to care for the regular trauma that we see every day. Falls and motor vehicle crashes and industrial accidents, et cetera. So I think it's just very important that we address our local healthcare, get the word out of how dangerous the wall is for anyone who may be considering scaling it. And I think we have to always, in our public health policy, consider what the effects are to our healthcare systems and make sure that we have resources provided if we're expecting an influx of patients such as we've experienced.
Dr. Amy Lippert is Medical Director of Acute Care Surgery at UC San Diego Health. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Over the past month, we've been checking in with Muslims across the globe to see how they're celebrating Ramadan this year. Now it's time for Eid al-Fitr, the three-day Muslim festival, which marks the end of fasting for the holy month. Since the holiday is largely centered around food, we ask people around the world what they're eating to mark the occasion.
Hi, my name is Sabal Jariri, and I live in Jerusalem, Palestine. My favorite dish in Eid is mansaf, which has many ingredients, such as rice, jameed yogurt, and meat. I love it the most because I have lots of memories with it. It reminds me of my grandmother and the way she used to do it with love and care.
I am Nabil Ahmed Rufai and I live at Ashalibuche in Accra, Ghana. My favorite food for the Eid celebration has always been rice and chicken stew. My mom makes it, and she has a special way of making it. And this particular meal reminds me of the way we grew up as children. Rice was basically a luxury for some of us who grew up very poor. So it's always a joy when Eid celebrations approach, and we know that definitely we are going to get that special meal.
Hi, my name's Nadia and I live in London, United Kingdom. My dad is from Tunisia and my mum's from Morocco. When it comes to Ramadan, it was very, really important to keep the essence and identity and culture alive at home. We traditionally have some dishes like harira, which is like a Moroccan chickpea soup. And then we'll have like a Tunisian brick, which is kind of like a filo pastry filled with eggs and tuna and potatoes. And it's, you know, bringing both cultures together on the table. They're beautiful traditions, there's beautiful stories, and it's our duty to try and keep those traditions alive.
Hi, my name is Aniket Alam, and I live in Hyderabad, India. The favorite Eid food memory that I have is the sheer korma that my grandmother used to make. And I remember seeing her making it in the kitchen, how she would fry the vermicelli in clarified butter, add those chopped almonds, the raisins, boil it in the milk, stirring it gently with the sugar. And it was a taste I have tried many times to recreate, just can't.
My name is Muhammadu Basirukui from Senegal. I remember when we were a kid, we have something called lach. It's a national dish from my country. It's very sweet. It used to be the first thing that we eat for breakfast, and it was so delicious. I'm still dreaming about it.
That was Ehub Al-Jariri, Nabil Ahmed Rafai, Nadia Hamila, Aniket Alam, and Mohamedou Basirupui sharing their favorite Eid meals. The music is Salam by Pakistani singer Shiraz Opal. We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Shockingly blue sky, a perfectly manicured garden, not a blade of grass out of place. Too good to be true? It is. It's the metaverse.
Some people have described it as 3D version of the internet. It's a life in a virtual space using an avatar version of yourself.
What South Korea is doing to make sure Silicon Valley doesn't control the metaverse, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The Venice Biennale, the world's oldest and arguably most important art exhibition, it started last week. This year saw a historic first. The Nordic Pavilion is filled with art made by the indigenous people of Arctic Europe, the Sami. Reporter John Last has more from Venice.
The Nordic Pavilion is one of the most peaceful spaces in Venice's Giardini. Filled with natural light and fresh air flowing through open doorways, three giant trees actually sprout through the roof, bringing nature's elements indoors. It's normally here that Norway, Finland, and Sweden stage their best artists in the Biennale's Cultural Olympiad. But this year, the sign bearing those countries' names is blocked by a sheet of reindeer skin. The interior is filled with murals depicting state violence and with taxidermied skins. It's become the Sami Pavilion, an occupation of sorts by the indigenous people of Arctic Europe. Katja Garcia-Anton is the curator.
You know, it was a project to, of course, to showcase the artists of the Sami Pavilion, but it's also a project intended to generate transformation across the Nordic art world.
Since 2014, Garcia Anton has been preparing this project with the goal of disrupting the colonial logic of the Biennale's World Fair format and passing the megaphone of the Venice art stage to Sami artists. For millennia, the Sami people have hunted, fished, and herded reindeer across Arctic Europe. But since the emergence of colonial states, they've often been subject to discrimination, their lands seized, cultures suppressed, and lives disrupted. Today, they're divided by four colonial borders, their families split between Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Russia. That history is very personal for one artist and activist featured in the Sami Pavilion.
My name is Tim Arjepsemmanlärapäälak, that is my Sami name.
She also goes by Paulina Fedorov.
My father's people, the Skold Sami, were forcibly relocated after the Second War from the Kola Peninsula.
The Kola Peninsula, at the very top of Scandinavia, is the homeland of the Sami people, since divided between Finland, Russia, and Norway. Fedorov's work in the pavilion is a layered commentary on that division, the sale and exploitation of her ancestral lands. As part of an elaborate performance and video installation, she is auctioning off the right to visit four endangered Arctic landscapes in her region.
And with the purchases, we are piece by piece buying the land back and then restoring them.
It's the first time that Sami people and their concerns, still barely heard in their own countries, have taken such a prominent place in a space defined by the contest of nations. But for the artists behind this historic moment, the feeling is bittersweet. Across the garden path from the Sami Pavilion is Russia's own grand structure. And this year, it's empty. Its delegates have been banned over Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
You know, when we first set out, having Russia in front of us was an opportunity to deepen connections, to keep dialogues going for the benefit of the Sami people in the Kola Peninsula. Of course, that door very firmly closed the moment that the war broke out.
Soon, Fedorov and others struggled to even send an email to longtime collaborators across the border. Meanwhile, Russian Sami communities were being roped into Putin's war. Reports quickly spread that the Kola Peninsula was providing some of the first and hardest-hit battalions involved in the conflict. Asked to toe the official line as their children were sent to war, Sami leaders were soon divided amongst themselves.
Some of the Kola Sami leaders have expressed publicly their support for Putin and his crimes. And it's a very painful situation.
At their pavilion in Venice, organizers decided against a public protest, fearing the consequences for Sami people in Russia. But even though there is no Russian Sami voice at this year's pavilion, Fedorov is adamant that they should not be forgotten.
We will not abandon those ordinary people who are just trying to survive.
The Sami pavilion will remain until November. Its curators hope that its presence might become a semi-regular occurrence. With luck, by next time, Sami artists from Russia and Finland could simply cross the garden path to meet each other again, the way they once traveled the lands of Europe's Arctic states before the time of borders. For The World, I'm John Last in Venice, Italy.
In Japan, job security has long been paramount. It's not uncommon for Japanese workers to land their first job, then stay at that company for life. These days, though, not so much. The work climate is shifting, and employers in Japan are increasingly having a tough time even finding workers. To understand what Japanese job hunters are now looking for and what employers can offer, we turn to Ulrika Schede. She's a professor of Japanese business at the University of California, San Diego. So for a college graduate in Japan, Ulrika, describe how much different things are today than they were for their parents.
So it's a seller's market in Japan right now, which means if you're an educated, aspirational, highly energetic, young university graduate, you can get any job you want and you can set the terms of employment. And that's the fundamental shift. So in the previous generation, there was still this idea of the salary man, where the expectation was you'd start working for a company and stay with them. Well, in Japan, it would be until the mid-50s, and then this company would find another job for you. And in return for that job security, you would relinquish the right to determine what you're going to specialize in, so what kind of job you do, or where you do that job. And the companies used to do this pretty much without looking at family constraints or personal situations or interests.
There was a whole culture and life path for the salaryman world. What is behind the shift? Because it seems major.
That's right. Yeah. So a couple of things are happening at the same time. One is that a lot of the young talent no longer want to be an indentured slave like that. They don't want to give up their choice on specialization or where they live. They want to be a modern man, right? They want to be involved in their kids' education and so forth and so on. So the definition of what a good employment is has changed. And then there is the labor shortage. Japan society is shrinking and the companies are trying to find these best employees. And then there's a negotiation. That's the new thing, right? And the companies are saying, well, if you don't promise that you're going to stay with us for the rest of your career, then we can't promise to educate you. And more young people are thinking that they want to be their own employment agent, so to say.
Well, today, people in Japan are prioritizing independence and what's known as ikigai, finding purpose in living. What does that mean in practice in this whole shift?
So it's not as if suddenly overnight a whole young generation wakes up and wants a different life, right? Plus, not all people that are in their 20s and 30s dislike lifetime employment. So it's still a very solid idea. And for the majority of people, it's very attractive to have this lifetime assumption. But many of the younger people are saying, I want to have my own specialization. I want to be paid by job, not paid in a membership system where everybody is paid the same and gets promoted the same. And fairness for me is no longer equal. It's equitable. So please pay me more and let me be who I want to be. And so these guys that are saying, it's mostly men, by the way, they are getting a lot of new recognition.
I mean, on that point, Ulrika, we've been talking salary man. It sounds like you're saying the shift is also benefiting Japanese women in the workforce.
Yes. Yeah, so the numbers are really quite encouraging. If you look at the people in their 20s, women are now occupying 30% of the managerial positions are at that level, like project manager or something. And if they stay on, then eventually 30% of Japanese managers will be women. So that's a good sign. And a lot of them want to have it all. They want to have children and a job. And that is becoming also a real thing. So in 2019, the government issued a new labor reform law that very much restricts overtime work. I mean, I've seen signs in elevators at Japanese companies where it says, remember to go home at 5 p.m. on Wednesdays.
Wow. You know, we've seen in other countries, including here in the U.S., that COVID played a role in opening up more flexible working conditions. How much did the pandemic speed this shift up in Japan?
Yeah, so the pandemic really put this whole thing on steroids. So, for example, when the working from home first started, most companies didn't have enough VPN addresses for people to log in safely. And so it took 6 months for some companies to set this up. But now it is set up. And similarly, people didn't have space at home. This is, of course, true all over the world. But a lot of people didn't have a quiet space where they could actually work from home. And people have also rearranged things and set up their home work environment. And this has opened up a lot of possibilities, including the very simple one of, as I mentioned, going home at 5 p.m., having dinner with the family, and then keep working from home if necessary.
Ulrika Shida is a UC San Diego professor of Japanese business and director of the Japan Forum for Innovation and Technology. Thank you very much. This is fascinating.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Since last summer in Tunisia, people there have been living through an unprecedented political situation. In that time, Tunisia's president, Kais Saied, has seized power, frozen the parliament, and dismissed the prime minister. And as Lilia Blaise reports from Tunis, all with little resistance from the public.
Vegetable prices have been high in this local souk and during the months of Ramadan. Shoppers are noticing because they are buying more for the traditional breaking of the fast. 30-year-old housewife Emna is holding her baby in her arms. She tells me she's trying to decide what she can purchase with 20 dinars or $7. Before you could do your groceries of the week with 20 dinars, now you need 20 dinars per day, she says. And sometimes it is still not enough. Everything is very expensive. I ask her, what are the things you cannot afford anymore? We used to buy a lot of fruits. Now we can't buy as many, she says. Banana costs 6 dinars, apples for 7 dinars, What are you going to buy to provide for four kids? You only buy the essential goods to survive. Many of the people at the market don't want to give me their last name because they are cautious with the media. On the other side of the road, Ashraf is selling strawberries and bananas from his truck. People buy the cheapest things, he says, so we adapt. But the quality won't be as good. We all know that the situation is bad, so we try to understand that and be patient. Ashraf tells me there is no interest into politics right now, given the situation of the economy. People only care about filling their stomachs, he says. Politics are fighting over power, but we, the people, we do not care. Emna agrees. She says she does not have the strength to express her anger in the streets. We used to hear about protests and see them all the time and nothing changed, she says. The revolution did not change anything, so these protests are useless. I ask her if she supported Kais Saied when he decided to dissolve the parliament. She says, we thought things were going to change for the better, and he is going to be the one in charge. But the opposite is happening. Prices are going up, and everyone is complaining. In 2019, Kais Saied was elected president, campaigning without a political party. He was known as a constitutional law professor who was frequently on television. Now he stands as a symbol of integrity for many Tunisians because of his lack of political ties and his strong dislike of any political system. After seizing power and then dissolving the parliament, he wants to reform the constitution for a more presidential regime and submit it to a referendum this summer. Political expert Youssef Sherif says there is little resistance to these moves.
With the current situation, one would expect a social explosion in the country, but that's not happening. And we don't see people complaining against Kais Saied.
Sherif says this is a result of many years of disillusionment.
Those who were there before July 25th are so unpopular and seen as the source of all evil in the country, for right or for wrong, that people keep thinking that they are the reason why things are so bad today.
So for many Tunisians, Sherif says, there is still hope that Kais Saied can do better.
Kais Saied is often seen as this very non-corrupt and very clean politician. However, the more the crisis continues, the more people will start asking questions and the more people will feel impatient.
Right now, the only unrest comes from a small opposition, led by some intellectuals and members of the Islamist Party. But they have difficulties to rally more than a few thousand people in the streets. I meet with Samira Shaweshi, the vice president of the parliament. The fragile Tunisian economy cannot bear another blow, she says. Any agreement with international funders cannot be done without a parliament. This situation is not good, Tunisians are disappointed, and the worst is that they are starting to give up on democracy, and that is the main risk. Another member of parliament, Abir Moussi, head of the Desturian Party, is also leading an opposition of her own. She was in favor of the dissolution of the parliament, but she's also pushing for new elections. She fears that Kais Saied will change the electoral law. She speaks with journalists before meeting her followers. Today, Kais Saied wants to take away the will of the Tunisian people, she says. The people want to vote for our party. We are leading the polls for legislative elections, and he does not like us. Today, the country needs elections and its constitutional institutions. Meanwhile, the president is set to implement his reforms and his new political model, whether they are considered as democratic or not. For The World, I'm Lilia Bless in Tunis.
The war in Ukraine is news that is on everyone's minds. It was bound to be a talking point at Saturday night's White House Correspondents' Dinner, the first one in 3 years due to pandemic restrictions.
It is my great honor to be speaking tonight at the nation's most distinguished super spreader event. No, for real, people, what are we doing here? Let's be honest, what are we doing?
host and headliner Trevor Noah spent nearly 30 minutes delivering one punchline after another, ripping politicians and the media. Then he evoked Russia's invasion of Ukraine by way of the unique freedoms American journalists have. Noah essentially asked the media in the room, are you using that freedom as well as you can and should?
If Russian journalists who are losing their livelihoods, as you were talking about, Steve, and their freedom for daring to report on what their own government is doing, if they had the freedom to write any words, to show any stories, or to ask any questions, if they had basically what you have, would they be using it in the same way that you do? Ask yourself that question every day, because you have one of the most important roles in the world.
Have you ever experienced the metaverse? It is shorthand for digital worlds visited through virtual reality headsets. Tech gurus predict it's the way people will spend time online in the future. But the government in South Korea doesn't want Silicon Valley to monopolize the metaverse. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports.
There's a golden sky overhead, streaked by clouds, and a manicured lawn beneath my feet. None of it's real, though. The birds, the sunset, it's all fake. Welcome to the metaverse. Well, a metaverse, one of several online worlds. This is the most popular one, called Decentraland. It's a hit among South Koreans. They're the top users after Americans. And being an imaginary realm, you might expect wall-to-wall, fantastical, even psychedelic wonders. Instead, I found a Samsung store. I go inside and it's just a pixelated replica of a Samsung store. How much Samsung paid to have this store is not disclosed, but it was a lot. Smaller plots of digital real estate here sell for $2 million. Individuals and corporations alike are scrambling to own property in the metaverse.
So metaverse is certainly a buzzword that we're hearing a lot, right?
That's Sang Kim with the Korea Economic Institute of America. I called her to find out why South Korea's government is so interested in the metaverse. But first, I asked her to define the metaverse.
Some people have described it as 3D version of the internet. It's a life in a virtual space using an avatar version of yourself.
That avatar might be anything, a more fit virtual version of yourself or, say, a talking penguin.
For South Korea, they've always been interested in the IT realm, and they really like to be the global leader in the IT realm.
South Korea has one of the most online societies on Earth, thanks in part to the government. Starting in the late 90s, it funded cheap access to internet for all citizens. Now the government wants to spend nearly $200 million to help South Korean tech firms compete in the metaverse.
So they're really seeing the government's role as laying down the infrastructure, creating space for their companies, especially the small and medium enterprises, to also build up their experience and really thrive, not only in South Korea, but globally as well.
That could mean loans to startups or helping set up special metaverse academies. Officials hope to create 1.5 million new jobs. Eventually, they also want citizens to put on video goggles and visit virtual offices to go to court or pay taxes. If this sounds like throwing tax money at a gimmick, consider South Korea's track record of funding new wave entertainment projects. South Korea is the pop culture powerhouse of Asia, in part because the state started financially supporting K-pop and K-dramas 20 years ago. As for Decentraland, it's not run by any government or corporation. It's basically a global co-op. But its designers have collaborated with startups funded by the South Korean government. Already, Korean investors are buying up real estate in Decentraland, including concert halls. Sang Kim says virtual shows by K-pop groups are hugely popular.
They're having digital virtual concert with millions of people watching at the same time.
The hype is real, and so is the money. After visiting the Samsung store, an incredibly dull experience, by the way, I toured other valuable properties in Decentraland. Million-dollar mansions, a district called Dragon City, where Chinese players congregate. There's even a nightclub owned by penguins, selling bottles of digital champagne for $140. In my unprofessional opinion, this metaverse does not feel all that immersive. Even the graphics are not so impressive. But listen to the promises coming from the top metaverse hype man, Mark Zuckerberg.
We believe the metaverse will be the successor to the mobile internet. We'll be able to feel present, like we're right there with people, no matter how far apart we actually are. We'll be able to express ourselves in new, joyful, completely immersive ways.
This is the guy South Korean developers have to compete with. Zuckerberg's metaverse isn't online yet, but it is backed by $10 billion. Sang Kim expects all these metaverse projects to fuel a conversation in South Korea about whether more immersion is a good thing.
For South Korea, there's long been debate about whether the gaming is really bad for the kids, how there should be a limitation on how much they spend playing games.
But the idea here is that the metaverse goes way beyond gaming. From Seoul to San Francisco, developers imagine adults throwing on goggles for stuff like work meetings, yoga classes, and even hitting the clubs. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
We end today in the late 1970s at the peak of disco. There is a direct connection from the era of Studio 54 to Paris in the 1950s, and that connection left us this weekend. Regine Zilberberg, better known in the high society disco circles and those who wanted to be a part of its glitz and glamour, just as Regine. She basically invented the discotheque as we understand it today. Regine Zilberberg grew up in Paris during World War II. Her mom left when she was very young. Her dad was taken to a prison camp by the Nazis when she was 12. Discotheques existed then, but they were secret hideaways with a record player where the occupying German soldiers and a few French hipsters would go and hear the likes of Duke Ellington. After the war, discotheques grew in popularity, but when Regine decided to open hers in 1957, she noticed something odd when the record on the jukebox came to an end. The room grew quiet, and as she told the BBC at one point, all you'd hear were the people in the club making out. So she got two record players and someone to change the discs, never leaving the air without music. Over time, her club, Chez Regine, became massively popular, pulling in celebrities and royalty. She taught Prince Charles to dance and admitted to having flings with several Hollywood stars, including Fred Astaire and Robert Mitchum. Regine duplicated her discotheque brand around the globe, from New York City to Kuala Lumpur. At one point in the 70s, there were 25 Regine franchises on three continents. Disco music was coming into its own, and the clubs grew bigger. And since her discotheques were not the kinds of places where cocaine and quaaludes were out in the open, the crowds she'd pulled in moved on to other places. Regine was also a singer, and one of her big hits was a French cover of a Gloria Gaynor disco classic. Today, Regine's version of I Will Survive says everything you need to know about this woman, from World War II orphan to international disco mogul dancing until the break of dawn. Regine Zilberberg died yesterday at the age of 92. That is our show on this Monday. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston, online at theworld.org. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you again tomorrow.